Hello and welcome to Asia Stream, where we track, report, and analyze the issues and interests of the world's largest region. I am Waj Khan, Nikkei Asia's digital editor here in New York City. Today's episode, China's big week, the coronation of Xi Jinping. It's been quite the week for China and China watchers. We're in the middle of the 20th National Congress of the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP. The massive event only happens once every 5 years. It's the time when the Chinese Communist Party shakes up its senior leadership and has an opportunity to change its constitution. This Congress is particularly notable because we're likely to see paramount leader Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the CCP, succeed at his bid to secure a historic third term. The heads of the party traditionally only lead for two terms, but it's been clear for years that Xi wants more. In fact, many suspect that he intends to hold the position for life. Rather than a reappointment, this is seeming more like a coronation, and the moment of truth is upon us. By the end of this Congress, which wraps up on Saturday, October 22nd, we'll officially see whether Xi Jinping tosses norms to the side and gets himself another 5 years or more. Given this meet the new boss, same as the old boss power move by Xi, what should we expect from this new era? How will what's happening right now at the Congress shape China in the years to come? And what does that mean for the rest of the world? Those are the questions we're asking today, with the help of our returning contributor, Lowy Institute's Richard McGregor. We've got a great episode ahead. Get comfortable and settle in, because clearly it's going to be a historically long tenure. You're listening to The Sound of Asia, streaming in your ear. From Nikkei Asia, this is Asia Stream.
A reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. Get 3 months of our award-winning coverage for just $9. To redeem, just click the link in the episode description.
Here in the studio to catch us up on the basics of the CCP Congress is Asia Stream correspondent Monica Hunter-Hart. Monica, welcome back.
Thanks, Wash.
So is this like the Communist Olympics? I mean, I know that sounds flippant, but what exactly is this Congress and why is it important?
I guess you're right that it repeats every 5 years in a cycle, but no, it's not exactly that. This is, in fact, the time when the new leadership is chosen for the Chinese Communist Party, which rules China. The process involves thousands of delegates gathering, then about 200 of those are appointed to the Central Committee. Some of those are then appointed to a smaller committee, and so on and so on, ultimately leading to the smallest and most important committee, the tiny group of leaders that runs the country. That is called the Politburo Standing Committee, and it's headed by paramount leader Xi Jinping.
Okay, so that makes perfect sense. But is there any, besides Xi, of course, who we'll come to, but is there any other particularly notable figures we should be looking out for amongst this group?
Yes, definitely. I mean, a few, but absolutely keep an eye on the premier.
You mean the number two guy, Li Keqiang?
Yes, exactly. So as you said, the premier is the position with the second highest rank in the party. Mm-hmm. Li Keqiang is very likely to be replaced. I should note that the premier isn't always the second most powerful person in the government. Hmm. Other members of the Politburo Standing Committee have been the equivalent of Xi's right-hand man in recent years. So Basically, you should be keeping an eye on other key positions as well. Actually, there are a lot of major positions that'll be changing hands. For example, we'll probably be getting a new central bank governor, a new finance minister, a new head of China's massive internal security apparatus.
Okay, and obviously, this is a particularly important moment for Xi Jinping himself.
That's right. All signs point towards him securing a third term in power as the head of the party, and that is a highly unusual move.
So I don't get that bit, right? How is this highly unusual? Because from the little that I know of Chinese history, didn't Mao rule from the 40s till the 50s through the 60s? Almost 3 decades or more.
Yes. No, he did.
So why is this special?
Well, yeah, that was a special case. Chairman Mao, of course, was the father of the Chinese Revolution. And since then, norms have changed. In recent decades, the heads of the CCP haven't stayed in power for more than two terms. After Mao left office, China went through a reform era, which included, among other things, encouraging less of an overt cult of personality around the leader.
Right. So I'm looking at the numbers here, the post-Mao leadership tenure numbers, and there's sort of like a decade medium, right? So Deng Xiaoping, right after Mao, he served for 11 years, Jiang Zemin for 13, Hu Jintao for 10. Everybody's in that 10-11 range, which is where Xi Jinping is as well. But why are people saying he's going to stay on forever?
Not necessarily forever, but yes, almost definitely for longer. And the writing has actually been on the wall for at least a half decade. So for one thing, Xi's two predecessors set up their succession processes well before stepping down from power, and Xi has refused to do that. Those men appointed heir apparents at the preceding CCP congresses. That's one of the major purposes of the Congress. It's a promotion ceremony of sorts. So Hu Jintao made Xi his heir apparent in 2007, and then Xi took control in 2012. But Xi very conspicuously did not do the same thing at the last Congress.
So there is no crown prince, so to say.
Right, no crown prince waiting in the wings, exactly. And then in 2018, the National People's Congress got rid of the two-term limit for the presidency. By the way, president is sort of how we anglicize Xi's positions. He actually holds three different titles, but we sort of sum it up like that typically.
Right. So he is the general secretary of the party. Mm-hmm. He is the paramount leader. Mm-hmm. And he's what? King emperor?
No.
He is, I'm just kidding, he is also the leader of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, technically.
That's exactly right.
Right, okay. No, I was just being flippant. I am quite a serious journalist, Monica, believe it or not. Okay, so just so I'm clear, he's going to be, Xi Jinping is going to be president, again, anglicized term, disclaimer in play, for the third time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, not to add one additional layer of complexity here, but it actually is slightly more nuanced than that. He is expected to be appointed, but he won't actually step into the role until March. That's true of the premier as well and other positions in the Politburo Standing Committee. Basically, this is the moment when the next group of leaders is queued up, not the moment they actually assume power. And actually, they will be literally queued up. On the final day, the new members of the Politburo Standing Committee will all file out on stage for the big reveal. That's when the world gets to see who they are.
Got it. And stepping back for a second, am I right in thinking that there's no real role for the 1.5 or so billion Chinese people in this entire proceeding?
Well, that's a really difficult and fraught question. I mean, Chinese citizens don't elect members of the CCP. They do elect members of their local people's congresses, which hold power at the local administrative level. And then those deputies elect the next level of congressional deputies, which elect the next, all the way up to the national legislature. So citizens have a very diffused electoral power. And no, they don't directly elect anyone who's going to be assuming government positions this week.
Right. So on the topic of the party's responsiveness to the population, I know many analysts have been arguing about Xi's consolidation of power over his tenure, that it's made him less accountable, less responsive. That's why he's dug in when it comes to zero COVID. He's dug in, he's doubled down on the very controversial zero COVID policy, despite cracks appearing in support of that policy. I mean, just a couple of days ago, before the Congress, banners went up over bridges in Beijing, besmirching Xi. This is not normal. Obviously, the banners were quickly removed, but they were caught on social media. They went viral for a minute before all of those videos were removed as well. But and now, Beijing's bridges have cops on them as this Congress is ongoing.
Yeah, it was pretty wild to see that. And we will hear more about zero COVID in a minute. You're definitely right that Xi has consolidated his power across the board, removing opponents, inserting allies everywhere he can. As just one example, the Wall Street Journal reported that at this point, all but seven of the 281 people on the provincial standing committees are his guys.
Wow. Okay. So I want to have 280-something guys on my side at any given day. But anyways, okay. So it's pretty clear that Xi, or Emperor Xi, if I may, will be the one continuing to set the direction for China's future. All right, so that was my Chinese Communist Party People's Congress 101 with Monica Hunter Hart. But without much further ado, let's tackle one of the biggest topics on the ground in China, zero COVID. How is the controversial zero COVID policy looming large as this Congress carries on? Alice French, our deputy big story editor, is discussing just that in this week's Tokyo Dispatch. Stay tuned.
Konnichiwa and welcome to the Tokyo Dispatch, where I send regular updates from the narrow streets and neon lights of Tokyo, home to Nikkei HQ and hub for our East Asia coverage. With all eyes on China's 20th Party Congress, last week's big story took a deep dive into the country's COVID-19 policy, asking for how much longer can Xi maintain his extreme antivirus measures, particularly as he seeks a third term in power. Ever since the beginning of the pandemic in early 2020, China has been home to some of the world's strictest restrictions to prevent virus spread. The country has been closed to visitors for over 2 years, and local governments have been tasked with reaching zero COVID cases within their jurisdictions. These targets require frequent and intense mass testing, along with extreme quarantine rules, which have put enormous financial pressure on local authorities. Our story, which was a collaborative effort by reporters both within and outside China, revealed that the debt balance of China's local governments has increased by 57% since the start of the pandemic, owing at least in part to the cost of conducting endless mass testing. A local official in Jiangsu province told one of our reporters that his government's fiscal situation was extremely serious, and economic analysts warned that China's economy could suffer irreversible damage if it doesn't drop its draconian measures soon. Nomura is already predicting an annual growth rate of just 2.7% for China this year, which is well below the country's target of 5.5%. This is bound to have an impact on foreign investors' decisions. And it's not just the economy that's taking a hit. There are also doubts about how long the zero COVID policy can go on without major social unrest, as families continue to be split up by quarantine, people are denied medical help for failing to provide a negative PCR test, and citizens have even been prohibited from evacuating their homes during earthquakes and wildfires due to lockdown rules. But despite the toll that China's policy is taking on its population, getting rid of all antivirus measures would also bring significant risks. Our story looked at a recent study by Fudan University, which estimates that reopening China would lead to over 1.5 million deaths within the first 6 months. This figure is based mainly on China's relatively low vaccination rates. Less than 40% of those aged 80 and over in China had received 3 jabs as of late July, compared to more than 80% in Japan. So China finds itself between a rock and a hard place. Keep going with zero COVID and risk economic hardship and potential civil unrest, or reopen and risk mass infection and widespread death. Many think Xi has been delaying a decision on this until after he has secured a third term at this week's Congress. So the next days and weeks may offer some hints about how China plans to tackle the post-COVID era. Xi will be forced to make a decision sooner rather than later, so watch this space. And take a look at the story, titled Self-Isolated, China's Lonely Zero COVID Battle in Spotlight as Xi Seeks Third Term, on the Nikkei Asia website for more details. This has been Alice French with the Tokyo Dispatch for Asia Stream. Matane!
Thanks to Alice French. Now, let's bring in our favorite China watcher, Richard McGregor, to discuss the Congress so far and what to expect in this era of Xi's renewed power.
Richard McGregor is Senior Fellow for East Asia at Australia's Lowy Institute, a former Beijing and Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times, and the author of numerous books on East Asia. He's also a frequent Nikkei Asia contributor. Richard, welcome back to Asia Stream.
Hi there, good to be with you.
So I want to start off by just getting your general impressions on the Congress so far. What has been particularly notable and what, if anything, has surprised you?
Well, there's a book written about the Ming Dynasty, which has if I remember the title of it correctly, I think it's 1597, A Year of No Significance, which I always thought was a great title for a book. Now, I'm not saying this Congress is, you know, a year of no significance, but it's been so far quite predictable. In other words, everybody predicted that Xi Jinping would be dominant. He is. People expected his policy program to be reaffirmed. It manifestly has been. So it's not like other party congresses where you know, things jump out at you from the shadows or from the side. And there's also been very few leaks. We often get leaks before party congresses. This one has been very tight. So it's really interesting, but it's not surprising.
Got it. I do want to touch on the question that everyone's sort of thinking about, which is, of course, succession. Xi himself, as we all know, is most likely going to secure a third term. But this is right about the time when we could see a potential successor coming up down the line, particularly depending on who is appointed to the Politburo Standing Committee. So is there anyone you're watching who could fill a role like that? Do you see anybody in particular emerging as a potential successor to Xi in, say, 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, the first thing to say is one has to be extremely humble about making any predictions of this kind, because at the top, Chinese politics is still a black box, so you have to be very careful. Secondly, I think you said it was most likely Xi would get a third term. I'd say it's now 100% certain, you know, casting humility aside for a second. As to the lineup, you know, in many respects, as to who's going to be premier, my guess is as good as yours. If you press me to make a guess, then I would go for Wang Yang, who's now kind of head of United Front work in the Politburo. But as to the succession, this is obviously a big question. Will Xi give any indication that he's anointing anybody as a successor? My instinct is no. That there'll be no clear line of succession. In fact, you know, it's the old joke. It'd be the, I think, the most dangerous place in China at the moment is to be nominated Xi Jinping's successor, because Xi is too powerful. He has the system too locked down for anybody to be critical of him, but a successor would be a big fat target. Now we'll see what happens when it's the leadership is unveiled in that, you know, uniquely party congress way. They have a kind of CCP catwalk where they walk out onto the stage of the Great Hall of the People in order of seniority. You know, it'll be unveiled then, but my instinct is no successor. Two or three more people out of the seven will step down. We'll get two to three more, and they'll be Xi, very much dominated by Xi acolytes. The leadership will be Xi's as far as the eyes can see.
You were saying that at this point, it's really 100% likelihood that Xi is going to be getting his third term. What was the turning point for that? When did it change from, you know, 95% to 100%?
You know, frankly, the turning point, and I was thinking about this, was today. It's really 2018. And when he ended term limits for the presidency, that flowed onto the position of party secretary, which is the important one in China. And there's literally been no indication since then that it would be anyone other than Xi Jinping. I guess there were some, you know, sort of wobbles around the outbreak of COVID in Wuhan in early 2020 and the subsequent lockdowns. But from the Chinese perspective, or the propaganda, the perspective of Chinese propaganda, the lockdowns were a big success. You know, only a handful of deaths. The official deaths in China is something like 6,000, a bit under. In America, it's more than 1 million. Now, even given Chinese undercounting, that's a big difference. So the party's been claiming that as a big success. COVID zero, of course, is wreaking havoc on the economy right now, but even that does not seem to have touched Xi or weakened him. At all. Right throughout the last 4 or 5 years, various power centers within the system continue to be locked down by Xi, most recently in the sort of security, internal security and police area. He hasn't flinched from confronting the United States. So, you know, really, without the benefit, without sort of relying on the benefit of 2020 hindsight, it's been staring us in the face for a number of years now.
So before we got on this call, you were telling me that you don't have a prediction for who's going to be in the leadership, but that in some respects, that is a less interesting question this year. That's an interesting way to put it. What did you mean by that?
Well, I guess, you know, it's very exciting when you see the new lineup unveiled, and it will be just as exciting this Sunday. You know, there are very few moments of genuine political theatre in China. It's an opaque grey system by design, a no surprise system. So we do get, a genuine surprise when we see the leadership unveiled. But I guess if to continue the theme of Xi Jinping's overwhelming dominance, one expects him to run the field or run the clock, however you say it, with the new leadership positions as well, and also in the Politburo and the Central Committee under that. Sometimes when you see the new leadership there, it gives you an indication of the relative power balance within the leadership. In other words, each group gets one or two positions, or there's some sort of offsetting mechanisms of the kind that you get in factional politics or party machines all around the world, in the classic sense of Tammany Hall. It's a balancing act and a patronage machine, and you've got to give everybody something. But once again, I think the indications are, and let's wait and see what happens on Sunday, that the new lineup will reinforce the same message that she is totally dominant at the moment. So in that respect, it will be less interesting than an era where you had more to calibrate.
It seems like one of the reasons Xi was doubling down so hard on his zero COVID strategy was because this Congress was approaching. Zero COVID is generally viewed as his biggest legacy. I mean, economic growth in China has slowed during his tenure compared to his predecessors. Of course, his administration has had impressive accomplishments like ending extreme poverty and the Belt and Road Initiative, although the latter is far from finished. But right now, nothing is looming quite as large as zero COVID. So if Xi does get reappointed this week, does that mean that he'll be free to loosen up that policy a bit because he's less concerned about the optics and how those may help or hurt his ability to secure a third term?
Well, this is the big question, what is the plan on zero COVID? We've had lots of speculation in the lead up to the Congress that that will be the moment when Xi will ease the policy. Maybe that's right, but every indication so far is that that's not the case. We had about 3 front page articles, I think, in the official party mouthpiece, the People's Daily, recently, all reaffirming the correctness of the policy. I think Xi said exactly the same thing in his speech. So I used to think a while back that, COVID zero was kind of tied to the political cycle. In other words, we'd get through the party congress, then we get through the National People's Congress, the government gathering, next February, March, when you get the new government appointed, and that would be the signal for some sort of relaxation. But I think that was I was wrong in that respect, and I think it's about much more than just the political cycle and Xi's own consecration. It's about health issues. I think in many respects, COVID zero has been quite a rational policy for China up to a point. Why do I say that? Well, the propaganda, the message the leadership has for the Chinese people is that we have saved lives. And of course, if China opens up, just like with any other country, we don't know to what extent, but if China did open up, many people would die. China does not have a great public health system, particularly in poorer areas. You've got a ton of elderly men in particular who've been smoking for 50 years. That's what we sort of euphemistically call comorbidities. And that's not a time in your life when you want to get a respiratory illness. Chinese vaccines do not offer as great a protection as their Western counterparts. Many elderly people have not got vaccinated, even though the rates have gone up recently, but many have not got vaccinated for 2 reasons. One is the government keeps telling them that they're protected, so they think, why would I bother? And secondly, there's sort of, anti-vaxxer undercurrents in China as well, people who think that there are side effects from getting a vaccine. So there's all sorts of things holding the unwinding of COVID zero back. I think we would have to wait to see a concerted public education campaign by the party. I don't think Xi can just flick a switch overnight and change the policy because I think there would be a cost for that, and they're not quite willing to test that out yet.
Do we have a sense of how the public feels about a third term from Xi? Is that generally a welcome move, or do people feel that it's an overstep?
Yeah, you've got to be pretty hesitant about being too dogmatic about that. You know, we don't have the type of, targeted and genuine opinion polling in China that you get outside of the country. Most surveys in China do show strong support for the Communist Party. And I suspect the Communist Party is popular, and I suspect Xi is popular. And that is not necessarily surprising, because until the recent year, Chinese GDP has grown strongly for four decades. Most people's lives have got better. And of course, the party controls the message as well. And so they can, make sure those higher living standards reflect well on them. So you wouldn't be surprised in that case if somebody were popular. Xi Jinping, I think the anti-corruption campaign that he's run is undoubtedly popular. You know, China's not unlike many countries where they don't mind seeing the big shots getting a kick up the pants and worse. So I suspect he's popular, but, one doesn't want to test that because there's no competition in the system against him. And on the polling and the like, which I think can be done professionally, I think Pew does some surveys there. I think one Chinese friend has put it to me, when people answer a polling question in China, they treat it like they're sitting for a test. You know, they've got to get the right answer. So with all those qualifications, I think the party's legitimacy is pretty solid.
So one of Xi's goals is and has been for a long time, of course, taking over Taiwan and reunifying it with the mainland. And he's been continuing to make that clear at the Congress this week. But notably, his tone, it seems a little bit more hawkish even than before. And we also have this new geopolitical backdrop to contend with. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, the world has been coming to terms with the idea that we may not have been taking authoritarian leaders' threats of invasion seriously enough in the past. What does a third term for Xi maybe mean in terms of Taiwan?
China definitely does not want to fight a war over Taiwan because it's so risky and potentially so calamitous. The trouble is that the public opinion in Taiwan is so decisively against any form of unification, and China's ability to persuade people otherwise is just about nil, and they've kind of given up on persuasion and seduction of the Taiwanese. They just tell them that this is what's going to happen. There's many ways to skin the cat before you get to an actual military conflict. It could be a blockade. It could be the sort of psychological pressure. All Xi has to do is to force Taiwan to the bargaining table, to cede the principle, if you like. For example, when Hong Kong returned to China, the Sino-British Agreement was made in 1982 and the actual return was 1997. So this can be a spun-out process as long as China wins the principle of, Taiwan becoming part of China. In terms of military conflict or, the situation becoming much tenser, it could happen very quickly, but I do think we've got the Taiwanese election in 2024, very early in the year. Then we've got the US election later that year. US military commanders, in as much as they've spoken about this, have kind of pinpointed 2027 as the sort of date when China's Beijing would be looking to move or have the ability or confidence to move. A lot can happen. One of the legacies of Ukraine is that China would understand that if they're going to do this, they've got to do it quickly. Mass their forces and do it quickly. Don't have a prolonged conflict because that allows all manner of people to rally against you. But there's not only the issue of, winning a war if it came to that, and I'm not saying it will, but you then have to occupy Taiwan. How do they do that? This is a sophisticated society. political parties, independent companies, courts, a bustling, thriving civil society. You've got to shut all that down. So it's a monumental task, which I'm sure China has multiple blueprints to execute, but actually doing it is another thing altogether.
Right. I want to move just to talking briefly about the big speech that she gave on Sunday. Of course, it was all about security. He was framing pretty much every issue from foreign policy to COVID to the economy as relating to safety and security in some sense. In one sense, that kind of a framing helps sort of justify his rule. He's positioning China as being threatened by all these external forces and himself as the savior. But on the other hand, China really does have a lot to be worried about right now. And I'm hoping that we can maybe just kind of get inside Xi's head for a minute almost. And from his perspective, what are these very real threats facing China in the near future? And what is the best way from his perspective to address them?
You know, Xi's like a lot of leaders around the world. In fact, China was probably well ahead of other countries in putting national security ahead of the economy. You see that kind of debate in Europe now. What are the threats? Well, there's obviously the perennial threats from the quote-unquote hostile foreign forces, which is, of course, primarily the U.S. You know, competition with the U.S. is hydra-headed. It's about technology, it's about the regions, about geopolitics, about the economy, about trade, but it's also a contest of systems. You know, the Communist Party is convinced that the U.S. wants to undermine it. Peaceful evolution, however you look at it. And so there's that. I think also Xi sees us at a decisive moment of opportunity for the party, at a moment when they've assessed that the US is weak and that China is becoming stronger. China under Xi particularly, but it has been for many years, is a mobilization society. They mobilize workers, they mobilize capital, and they also, mobilize sentiment. That's, I think, lies behind a lot of, so in that respect, it's a kind of a wartime economy, which doesn't mean it's about to fight a war, but it has that wartime economy, society feel about it. And I think that Xi thinks that he has, that underlies a lot of what drives Xi's policy to, keep the society on edge for struggle, as he constantly calls it, for a potential showdown with the United States. And I think he thinks that's a great advantage for China over, feckless democracies, that they are all up for the fight. So that's, I think, what lies behind all of that rhetoric.
Got it. And then lastly, just very briefly, what can we expect domestically in China to happen under a third term?
Well, they've got to get through COVID zero. And it doesn't look like that's going to happen, before, mid to early next year. And that will take a while to unwind as well. And we don't know whether that'll come with genuine travel in and out of China, or simply whether within China movement will be freer. COVID zero has made much worse two of the big other problems in China the party is focusing on. One is the fertility rate and a rapidly declining population. I think the fertility rate has gone down even lower during COVID, and why not? You wouldn't really want to start a family right now. And secondly, it's made the property market jitters even worse as well. On top of which, China is suffering the same afflictions from climate change that many countries are around the world. They've had record floods and, of course, a record hot summer this year as well. So there's all those sorts of things. What is going to happen immediately? That's a good question, because when he came to power in 2012, he came out of the blocks with lots of initiatives. China's got some big initiatives, global initiatives on its plate now, a security initiative, and a sort of more broader diplomatic initiative. But it's pretty hard to move on at the moment while the country is locked down. So the big agenda is how to get out of COVID zero.
Richard McGregor, thank you so much for coming back on Asia Stream.
Thank you, Monica.
That's it for Asia Stream this week. As always, I encourage you to head to Nikkei Asia at asia.nikkei.com for more in-depth coverage of China and all things related to Asia. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share, subscribe, and leave us a review and hopefully a 5-star rating. And, of course, a last reminder that Nikkei Asia is currently offering an exclusive discount for our podcast listeners. To get the discount, click the link in the episode description. Use your fingers and thumbs. Click away. This episode was produced by Monica Hunter-Hart. I'm your host, Waj Khan. We're taking a couple of weeks off for travel and reporting, but we'll be back on November 10th with some exciting content. So don't float too far downstream.